The next day we put in at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him leave to go to his friends and be cared for. Putting out to sea from there, we sailed under the lee of Cyprus because the winds were against us. And when we had sailed across the open sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia and came to Myra and Lycia, which is so far about 2 weeks' travel, there the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing for Italy and put us on board. We sailed slowly for a number of days and arrived with difficulty off Cnidus, which is difficult to say. And as the wind did not allow us to go farther, we sailed under the lee of Crete off Salmon. Coasting along with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens, near which was the city of Lycia. Since much time had passed, and the voyage was now dangerous because even the fast was already here, which is Yom Kippur, and that's at that point probably about the 5th of October, mid-autumn, heading into dangerous weather. Paul advised them, saying, "Sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives." But the centurion paid more attention to the pilot and to the owner of the ship and to what Paul said. And because the harbour was not suitable to spend the winter in, the majority decided to put out to sea from there on the chance that somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbour of Crete, facing both southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there. Let's pause for a moment. Paul is speaking what we would call common sense. Now, he's no sailor, but he is a seasoned traveller. And he knows the risks, at least some of them. He knows the weather is turning, not in their favour. They've already been travelling with difficulty along the coast. And he knows, like everyone knows, that their boats are not really very seaworthy. Do not think of the America's Cup when you think of the kinds of things they are sailing in. They hug coastlines because their boats aren't that stable. Paul's concern is therefore sensible. However, it is also sensible for the centurion to pay more attention to the pilot and the ship owner than Paul. Paul is a tent maker. He is a theologian. He's not a sailor. Were I the centurion, I think I would listen to the sailors, to the pilot, i.e. the captain, and to the one who owned the boat and had, in a sense, at least more to risk than anyone else if things go down. I think he's making a sensible decision. And of course, the pilot and the owner are very familiar with the risks. What Paul has said is no surprise to anyone. But here's something that they also know. They can't stay there. This is not a good harbour. If there is trouble, there is no guarantee that staying in that harbour will be safe. So what they've decided, as if there's a chance, they will head out for another harbour. And if you can see, and I think there's a pointer on this. There we go. If you can see, they're somewhere around here, and they want to get to there. Fair Haven to Phoenix. Doop. It doesn't look far. It's in the lee of the same island they're on. It makes sense. You're talking about a maybe 70-kilometre crawl along the coast to Phoenix, a true safe haven. This is a situation, though I have never been in a situation where I've been in a port that I shouldn't stay in and a better one down the coast and worried about storms. This is a situation that I am very familiar with. I can't stay where I am, but there's a risk at moving. And I'm sure if you've lived a little bit, you know exactly what I'm talking about. You have your own situations that come to mind. I'm in a place I shouldn't stay. it's kind of okay. But there's a better port down the coast. There's a better place to be further on, but it's risky to go for it. It's a difficult choice to make. Either decision is going to cost you something, potentially. Maybe, for instance, as parents, you might have come across a situation, your child is not doing well in school. And so you think to yourself, or you discuss with your husband and wife, or wife, not and, you don't have both. Do we move them to another school? Or do we stay here and see if we can make it work? It's not ideal. But there's no guarantee the next school is going to be better. What do you do? Maybe you've been in a situation where you struck down a path with a particular career, and then somewhere down the track, after all the training and some years spent in it, you think, this is just not a place I want to be anymore. I don't want to stay in this career. But to change, I have to retrain. Maybe I have to stay at the back, start at the bottom of the ladder again. Can I afford to do that? And there's no guarantee that the next career will be any better than this one. Do I stay in this one, though it's difficult? Do I move into the uncertainty of a future I'm not sure of? Even how the elders felt about COVID passports and management of COVID. What do we do? Whatever decision we make, it's going to hurt someone. There is no decision we can make that is cost-free. So what do you do? Facing these situations with no easy or clear or risk-free answer happens more often than we would like to think. And in these situations, if someone comes along predicting disaster, it's really shooting fish in a barrel, isn't it? It's easy to do. Oh, well, if you do that, it could go horribly wrong. Oh, well, of course. Thanks. I know that. Oh, but if you don't move, it could be horribly. I know that too. You're telling me nothing I don't know. You're useless to me right now. If you don't have better things to offer, then let me make the decision. So thanks, Paul, but we all know this. Now, when the south wind blew gently, supposing that they had obtained their purpose, this was their chance to strike down the coast, they weighed anchor and sailed along Crete close to the shore. But, ooh, the but. Soon a tempestuous, or in Greek, typhonicus, i.e. typhoon, wind called the nor'easter struck down from the land. And when the ship was caught and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and were driven along. Running under the lee of a small island called Corda, we managed with difficulty to secure the ship's boat. After hoisting it up, they used supports to undergird the ship. So what I discovered in my studies here is what they would do is they would put straps around the boat. And they were trying to keep the timbers together, trying to stop the spine of the boat from breaking. They were trying to make it stronger so it would be more seaworthy. Then fearing that they would run aground on the Syrtis, they lowered the gear, which is either the mainsail or the sea anchor, to slow their progress, and thus they were driven along. Since we were violently storm-tossed, they began the next day to jettison the cargo. And on the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest lay on us, all hope of our being saved was at last abandoned. This is the point of desperation. The moment when you've done all you can to survive. Every measure you can take, you've taken. Every step you can take, you've trod. And there is no relief in sight. A storm still lays heavily upon you and rages without end. And at that point, you have one last thing to throw overboard. The one thing that has kept you going so far. Hope. The last thing they throw overboard when they have nothing left to do is their hope. You know, hope hurts. When you've been battered ceaselessly like this poor ship and all its crew, it can begin to feel too painful, even cruel, to hold on to hope. Hope helps you hold on. It's the thing that makes the desperate cling on. But when there's nothing left to hold on to, and hope feels like it's just prolonging the agony. Have you been there? Have your decisions at times put you in a place where you thought, there's no way out of this? I've done everything I can. I made the best call I could. And it still ended badly. Like, suicide is the response of someone for whom holding out in hope has become too much. They have suffered too much. They have no reserves left. They have done all they can in their power to keep going, and they are empty, without options, and the storm still rages, and they say, enough. At that point, they just wanted to end, and giving up even feels like a mercy. I don't think I've been there. I don't think I've ever feared for my own safety and given up hope for myself like that. I think I have for someone else, but not for myself. And I am by very nature a hopeful person. It takes a lot to get me to that point anyway. But others are not of that nature, and others face more difficult things than I've faced. Some people, as my father used to remind me of a saying that was given to him, I have to remind myself that everyone is sitting in their own pool of tears right here, right now. You have something you're not sure you have an answer for. It might be a relational issue. It might be a financial issue. It might be a health issue. It might be a faith issue. But you're sitting there thinking, yeah, I've done all I can, and I'm out of reserves. And I don't know if I should carry on with this. Anyway, I have a lot of sympathy for this crew. And it seems so too does Paul and God, because comfort is on its way. We carry on in verse 21. Since they had been without food for a long time, Paul stood up among them and said, "Men," now this is not a great moment, "you should have listened to me and not have set sail from Crete and incurred this injury and loss. Yet, now, I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you." So now he was wrong. He predicted that everyone would lose their lives. Turns out he was wrong. "Only of the ship." I was right in that case. "For this very night, there stood before me an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I worship. And he said, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar. And behold, God has granted you all those who sail with you. So take heart, men, for I have faith in God that it will be exactly as I have been told. But we must run aground on some island.' When the 14th night had come, as we were being driven across the Adriatic Sea, about midnight, the sailors suspected that they were nearing land. So they took a sounding and found 20 fathoms. A little further on, they took a sounding again and found 15 fathoms. And fearing that we might run on the rocks, they let down 4 anchors from the stern and prayed for day to come. As the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship, and had lowered the ship's boat into the sea under pretense of laying out anchors from the bow, Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved. Then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the ship's boat and let it go. And as day was about to dawn, so all these events, since Paul stood up to try and encourage them to now, it's been about a night and a day. Paul urged them all to take some food, saying, today is the 14th day that you have continued in suspense and without food, having taken nothing. Therefore, I urge you, take some food. It will give you strength. Not a hair is to perish from the head of any of you. And when he had said these things, he took bread, and giving thanks to God in the presence of all, he broke it and began to eat. Then they all were encouraged and ate some food themselves. We were in all about 276 persons in the ship. And when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship, throwing out the wheat into the sea. I want to contrast this story. Are you all right, sweetie? What's the matter? You want to go over there? That's what Paul said. I want to contrast the story to another story of a ship in a storm. In this story, Jesus is in the boat with his disciples. But he's fallen asleep. It's been a heavy day. In fact, he has a fairly difficult life. And he's asleep in the boat when a storm rolls in. These were with waves big enough to sweep over the boat. And yet still, Jesus sleeps. Now on this boat, of course, we know that some are fishermen, and they know this is not a good situation to be in, and they're terrified. When your sailors are terrified, that's when you freak out. If you're on a plane and the staff are starting to run around like, you know, chooks with their heads cut off, then you know the plane's going down. You should be concerned too. And Jesus is still sleeping. The disciples wake Jesus up looking for help. So he gets to his feet and he rebukes the storm. That's a literal translation. He rebukes it. He says, stop being so rowdy, calm down. And the waves calm and the wind goes quiet. And then he rebukes his disciples. Where is your faith? Now, depending on which way the story goes, in Mark it's that way around. In Matthew, he criticizes his disciples first and then he calms the storm. But, you know, does it really matter if they could both say it different ways? Now, some people, I think, treat faith like an exercise in trying to wake up Jesus. They find themselves in trouble and they think their job is to find a way to wake Jesus up, because the reason we're with Jesus is so he can calm storms, right? Their faith is in Jesus to cure that problem. If they can just wake him up, or if they're really faithful, they'll wait for him to wake up, because once he wakes up on his own accord, then of course he'll calm the storm. However it is, that kind of faith leaves a person burdened, anxious, distressed, worried, terrified. And we learn in this story that Jesus calmed the storm for faithless disciples. It didn't matter that they had faith. It wasn't the reason he calmed the storm. He calmed the storm because they didn't have faith. And he did not rebuke the disciples for failing to calm the storm in their own, as if he was hoping that Peter would stand up and say, well, I know what Jesus would do. Be still. He didn't expect that of them. It wasn't a test of whether they thought they were godlike. He challenged them for losing their cool when things got tough, which has, I admit, even now, seemed a little harsh to me. But let us return to Paul in this terrible, endless storm. There is no Jesus in the boat to wake up. And everyone has given up. They have accepted, they're going to die. And perhaps even Paul believes that too. There's no reason to assume up to that point or the point of his angelic visitation that he thinks other than he too will die. And nor does he think that his role as a man of faith is to stand up and pretend to be Jesus and make the storm go away. Unless he did, and Luke thought it was a bit embarrassing because nothing happened, and so he just didn't write it into the story. I prefer to think that he didn't try. In the darkness of this despair, the Lord sends Paul an angel, a messenger with a message of hope. Though the boat will go down and everything on it will be lost, all souls on board will live, and no one will be harmed. And Paul stands up and shares this message of hope and salvation, telling them to have courage, take heart, we're going to be okay. But they're not encouraged yet. The sailors try to sneak off and leave everyone else to their doom. And it's only when Paul stands up and breaks bread that the mood changes. Only when they see Paul preparing himself to live on that they find in themselves courage again. And I find that interesting. Do you think they would have felt the same degree of courage from Paul if they could see him safe on shore somehow through some mystical power? They perceived Paul on the shore calling out, "It's going to be fine, guys," and breaking bread and saying, "Just have something to eat." Do you think they would have felt as encouraged? Or would they say something like, "Well, it's fine for you to say, Paul. You're fine. You've got no skin in the game. Your hope is easy, safe on shore as you are." Or do you think it's because Paul, having gone through everything they've gone through, been on the boat with them the whole time, suffered everything, as drenched to the bone over 14 days of tempest as they are, and in that same moment, in the same circumstances, he is able to stand up and say, "I have hope to live. I'm breaking bread and I'm going to eat because I'm going on and you guys are going on too. You're coming with me. This boat isn't going down because I'm on board and God wants me to be in Rome. So take courage, guys. Eat some bread." And they are encouraged. My father will lead us in communion soon. And for me, this scene exemplifies the true power, the true purpose of what we call communion. Common union. It speaks of the bond of total solidarity that Christ has with us, that we know for sure because he gave his life for us. Or to put it another way, he did not stand on the shore or in the heavenly throne room saying, "It's going to be fine, guys." He got in the boat and went down with it and then came up 3 days later. So that when he says to us in our moment, "If you go down, guess what? We go down together. And because we go down together, we come up. I'll bring you up together. You're going to be fine. You're going to be fine. Yeah, you're in a really bad space. Let's not gloss that. This is bad. It's terrifying. But Christ with us. We're entering the Advent season right now. Emmanuel, God with us. That is not a nice title. That is a real thing. Christ, God with us. See now, remember the situation they found themselves in, which got them into this situation? They can't stay in that harbor. It's not good enough. If they go on, it's going to be risky. And sure enough, it proves to be risky. We might be inclined at times to think, "I made a bad decision. That's why I'm in this place, because God has cursed me or God has abandoned me, and that's why it's hard. I have forgotten to follow the will of God, and now, oh gosh, now look at the situation I'm in. It must be a sign that I did the wrong thing, The story here says no. No. Living is hard. There are no easy choices. You are going to make difficult decisions all the time. And if you don't know in the root of your being that God is with you, you will lose your cool. You will lose your foundation. You will lose your footing. You will lose yourself. You will lose your mind. You will lose your faith. It doesn't matter what you find yourself in. God is with you in Christ. He cannot leave you or forsake you. Don't worry if you're not a brilliant decision maker. He's a perfect leader. Don't worry if the decision you make leads to trouble. If you didn't make the decision and you made the other one, that might have led to trouble too. It's not on us so much as it's on him. And he's fine with that. Yes, God can calm storms. Jesus proved his unique authority over all things when he stood up and calmed that storm. They saw that he was different when he did that. Not that they thought that they should be the same. But there's something that God can do for us that's even better than calming the storms we find. That is better for us, and that is this. He can calm us no matter what storm we find or what storm finds us. That is the promise. That is the story of this story. And I have not been in a shipwreck situation like Paul, but I know what he's talking about. And I think you do too. And if you don't, I hope you find that. That security of being found in Jesus. So the story ends. Now, when it was day, they did not recognize the land, but they noticed a bay with a beach in which they planned, if possible, to run the ship ashore. So they cast off the anchors, left them in the sea, at the same time loosening the ropes that tied the rudders, then hoisting the foresail to the wind, they made for the beach. But striking a reef, they ran the vessel aground. The bow stuck and remained immovable, and the stern was being broken up by the surf. The soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, lest any should swim away and escape. But the centurion, wishing to save Paul, kept them from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and make for the land, and the rest on planks or on pieces of the ship. And so it was that all were brought safely to land. There's a bit more of the story. I'm not going to bother with it. You can read that for yourself. I just have a question for us all. And I'll leave a bit of silence. When hardships come, not if, when, what is your final resting place? We all go through emotional ups and downs. We are mortal. We do feel fear. But do you settle somewhere? Do you settle in the anxiety and the fear? Or do you find that resting place when you go, no, it's not a good place, but nevertheless, I believe God is with me. Where do you settle? And I just want to pause and let you think about that. And Dad, when you're ready, you can lead us in communion.